Okay, folks, welcome to another edition of ITE 1, Class 1, Chapter 13, Advanced Laptops. And as you can hear, my voice isn't in particularly good condition today, so I'm going to hand over today's lecture to Elise, who will take you through all kinds of things to do with laptops, including forms of wireless communication, how to replace various components, and of course the inevitable preventive maintenance and troubleshooting. So have fun. I'll be staying on the sidelines. I'll still be here. So, and I will come back in just before the end to talk administration. Over to Elise.
Thanks, Kylie. Good afternoon and evening and morning to everyone out there. And today we're switching roles because Kylie can supervise me because no doubt I'll get something wrong. Today's chapter is 13, which is advanced laptops and portable devices. Now, back in chapter 6, we discussed the differences between laptops and desktop type PCs. Now, can anyone hark back to chapter 6 and remind us what some of those differences are?
One of them is integrated keyboard and screen.
Yep.
Portability.
And that's the big thing, isn't it, John? I like both answers, but of course everyone goes for portability first because that's really why we get them. Some of the other differences, of course, would be that laptops traditionally run slower, and even though I've got an i7 processor in both my desktop PC and my laptop, it's a different i7 processor. Because they run slower, because the heat buildup would be too great. So therefore we have a sort of more power conscious type computer. Plus your lap would get too warm, I guess, and things would go nastily wrong if it got too hot. So ventilation is very crucial.
Yep.
In the
there's also sorry, Kylie, did a you biggie. There's also a biggie about components. Can anyone say what it is? There's a big difference when you choose components for a desktop and a laptop. A big difference. Can someone tell me what that is?
The components are...
We're at a collision. Go ahead. We'll take Kate first and then Kim.
The components are often proprietary, and also they make a much smaller form factor.
Yep. And Kim?
Oh, I was going to say the same thing.
Sorry, dear. Well, there you go. So... and I know because I know Kim so well, laptops is one of her favourite types of computers. So, yeah, and it's a personal choice too. I mean, so I revamped this computer last year when it blew up. But I also like the idea of having a laptop for portability for when I go out on site and that sort of stuff. There are people like Kim who will just prefer to have a laptop at home. And that's becoming more common. So it's really a personal choice. And part of the IT course here explains, obviously, the differences so that you're empowered to make that personal choice as you are empowered to guide your client or your customer if they were faced with a similar decision. Now, in this particular lecture, we'll go into to detail about some of the things you've already learned, some of the things you probably already know because you're all IT people anyway, and you probably know a lot of this stuff just by your interest in it. Obviously, wireless is a big part when we're talking about laptops and portable devices, so we'll be discussing that. We'll be describing repairs for laptops and portable devices. We'll be selecting laptop components, and we'll also discuss preventive maintenance techniques for laptops and describe how to troubleshoot a laptop. Okay, any questions before we launch into 13.1, which is wireless communication methods? Evidently not. One of the great advantages of a laptop is, as you've already mentioned, is portability. So we like to use various wireless systems so we can be free of cables when we connect to the internet and other networks. Basically, we've got Bluetooth, which is a common technology, infrared, and of course Wi-Fi. Let's have a look at Bluetooth. Bluetooth, as you know, is a short-range wireless technology which can connect up to 7 devices. Now, I've not looked at the exam. I was going to, but we got busy before, so I don't know what's in the exam, given the fact that I've only presented Chapter 13 once before. So just be aware of, when you read your notes and listen to this lecture back, that things like 7 devices and that sort of stuff. Usually when I see that sort of thing put into a Cisco course, they probably obviously want you to know it. So Bluetooth can connect up to 7 devices. It's what's known as a wireless personal area network, or WPAN. I often used to hear when I was studying PAN, which is a personal area network, but they're now using the term WPAN. It conforms to the IEEE 802.15.1 standard. That's the IEEE 802.15.1 standard. Now, obviously, Bluetooth communications can handle voice and data, video, and is ideally suited to connecting the following types of devices: laptops, printers, cameras, PDAs, cell phones, and hands-free headsets. The distance of a PAN or a Bluetooth personal area network is limited by the amount of power used by the devices, and there are really three classes, and we'll go through those. So it's really limited by the power. Now, if I can get this, what was probably once a table that Kylie's reformatted into text, right, we'll see what we can do about reading this to you. Because thank you, Kylie, you've got some wonderful notes here. Thanks, girlfriend. Okay, these Bluetooth classes, there's three of them. Okay, now it looks like, what's the MW mean, Kylie? Is that maximum wattage?
I'd say, yeah, or it might be even milliwatts. I think it's the power rating.
Maximum permitted power, I think, maybe. Sorry, what was that?
I thought it might be milliwatts, but it's hard to tell actually what that is.
I would suggest you're probably right, because class one has 100 MW, and there's little m, big W too. It's interesting. So, yeah, perhaps it is a milliwatts. All right, just be careful of that. 100 MW is class one, and it goes for 330 feet or 100 metres. Class 2 is 2.5 MWs, probably milliwatts. It can't be. I don't know. I'm going to need to reset. 100 milliwatts in class 2 is 2.5 MW. I don't know what that MW is. I really don't. That's why we don't need it in the exam, gang. If you do, get and study. It goes... Oh, well, actually, it would be 2.5 because it's actually got less range, according to this little table. It's 33 feet or 10 metres. Oh, I see, because that's what, when I was studying, basically that was the standard, 10 metres, to be blunt, for a
Bluetooth thing. It's actually still the most common.
Yeah, because I remember sitting there when I first got my TomTom and it was trying to connect with my mobile phone. I was playing with a TomTom one side of the room, and the mobile phone would have probably been about 10 metres away from where I was. So that's the class 2, which is 2.5 probably milliwatts, running at 33 feet or 10 metres. As Kylie said, that's the standard that's most commonly used. And class 3 is 1 milliwatt or 1 MW, which is 3 feet and 1 metre. Any questions on that so far?
No, but it's very interesting playing with your Braille note, say, on a train. And it's absolutely incredible how many people's phones you can find on a train.
Yeah. I should get my Bluetooth places working on the new laptop I got. Actual fact, I did have it once working on the previous version of my Triple E, and I could sit on a train and go looking around all the devices you can find. Yeah. All right. Now, all of this Bluetooth business operates up at around about 2.4 gigahertz. 2.485 gigahertz, to be precise, in the unlicensed industrial, scientific, and medical band, or the ISM band, ISM. And we learn about that in Discovery, don't we, Kim?
Yep, we do.
We did. This is, as the name suggests, it's unlicensed, which means everything is up there. Wi-Fi, people with their little playabout little helicopters and things and remote controls and microwave ovens and cordless phones and Bluetooth, and it's all unlicensed and... and even cordless headsets, as Kylie and I were discovering last year. They're all up there. So you do learn about that sort of stuff in the Discovery course if anyone here wants to go on further with further studies in Chapter 7 of that course. Bluetooth is a low-powered, small size type situation, and it uses what's called adaptive frequency hopping, or AFH. And this will allow signals to hop around using different frequencies or channels, different frequencies really, within the Bluetooth range, thereby reducing the chance of interference when multiple Bluetooth devices are present. So there you go, that's how it gets around. So it does do some adaptive frequency hopping. AFH also allows the device to learn the frequencies that are in range, that are already in use, and allows the device to choose a different subset of frequencies. Now, here we go with this version business again. Version 1.2, was that versions or classes before? Now, we did classes before. Now, we've got versions.
Yeah, this is versions.
Yes, make it hard, why don't you? Come on, let's go. Different versions, 2.1. This operates at 1.2 megabits per second. Okay, 2.0 has enhanced data rate, or EDR, and that'll allow you to have 3 megabits per second. And 3.0 at high speed is 24 megabits per second. Now, again, I've not had a chance to look at this version's Chapter 13 exam, so I can't give, unless Kylie might be able to give you hints as to what's in the exam. She's probably looked at it.
Not for a little while.
So no test alerts today. Okay, all right, let's go. Okay, now to set this lot up, you need to authenticate using a PIN, or personal identification number. Bluetooth can also support 128-bit encryption. So there you go, a little bit of security here. Any questions thus far?
I've also discovered that, most of the devices I use the same PIN, which is usually 0000, and that seems to work with That seems to work with everything, but I've noticed that on the internet you can actually get specific pins, so that if you really wanted to encrypt something, the internet does provide you with pins in similar way to the internet can provide you with wireless.
Yeah, well, I think I got when I was pairing my mobile phone with my EEE, have not yet done so since. So I rebuilt the EEE. I got asked to put in a four-digit number, and they had to coincide on both devices.
I have one comment.
Yes.
Yep, go ahead, John.
The MW refers to power amplifier.
Yep, go ahead.
The MW refers to power amplification.
Amplifier. Oh, okay, probably what's power... amplification being watts, or watts being the unit of measure for power or something. Is that what you're sort of like trying to say?
Well, I just asked a friend of mine that's an electrician, and he said it's power amplification.
Something we might look up to see what we can come back with next week, hey? Yeah, well, he's probably right. It's probably an interesting way of looking. So I might check that out. But yeah, it's interesting that. We'll see what we might Google it all up later and find out what we come back with. Okay, another way of connecting mobile devices is infrared technology. Now, I actually played around with this back in about 2004, 2005, and was horrified that it was crappy. It was awful. I hated every second of it. And solely because the guy who was selling me the mobile phone back then was a bit unsure of Bluetooth and couldn't articulate it or describe it properly, and said, "Oh, you don't want to get Bluetooth every time you walk anywhere near something that's going to go off." Idiot. I wish I had Bluetooth. Which I went to a few years later anyway. IR, it's another wireless technology that's short-range, low-powered. It transmits data using LEDs, or light-emitting diodes, and receives data using photodiodes. IR wireless networks are globally unregulated. However, the Data Association, IRDA, does actually define the specifications for wireless communications, or IR communications rather. And there are 4 types of IR networks. Okay, here we go. Line of sight, where the signal is just transmitted from say your remote control to your TV or something. So it's line of sight.
It's a test alert.
It's a test alert. So if something gets in the way, you're going to block the beam. Okay. So it's a clear, unobstructed path between the devices. Scattered, or scatter, where the signal is bounced off ceilings or walls. Now, I used to lie in bed when I was about, 18 years old, and play with the remote control that came with my CD player and scatter that off the opposite wall just because it had a really good remote control, basically, and I thought it was being clever. Reflective, where the signal is sent to an optical transceiver and is redirected to the receiving device. And broadband optical telepoint, interesting. The transmission, in this instance, the transmission can handle high quality multimedia requirements. In other words, it's probably lots more data going through it. So that's this broadband optical telepoint. Here I was, thinking that infrared was just good enough for using, for pointing remote controls at idiot boxes. An idiot box is the Australian vernacular for a television set. And there's people using this technology for other things. There you go. All right, IR is designed for close range stuff. It can be used for multimedia projectors. Frankly, I wouldn't trust it as far as you could bloody throw it. PDAs, printers, remote controls, wireless mice, and good grief. That would be interesting, just put none too fine a point on it. And wireless keyboards. That too could be interesting. It's simple to set up. If you plug in a USB IR device, which I used to in Windows 2000 and have no end of trouble with it, but since XP and Vista and 7 and stuff, it's probably come a long way. Basically, you plug in your device, and simple as installing the driver, or the operating system will probably do that. With PNP, plug and pray, plug and play, and supposedly get on with your life. It does have some limitations. Finally. Okay. IR light cannot penetrate ceilings and walls, nor can they can penetrate the bozo who stands in between you and your TV set when you're trying to change channels. IR signals are susceptible to interference and dilution, interesting word, by strong light sources such as fluorescent lighting. Yeah, that's, I've heard that before. I've never seen it happen, but I can't see why it wouldn't, to be honest. I wonder what would happen if you put your IR devices near a heater or something, whether that would actually have some fair bearing on it too. Some more disadvantages is that scatter IR devices are able to connect without the line of sight, but are susceptible to data transfer rate loss. In other words, things will get slower if you're scattering it rather than going line of sight. And IR distances should be 3 feet or 1 meter when used for computer communications. So it's not good enough to stand across the living room with your remote control, like if you were sort of like switching the TV off or something. Frankly, I had the IR transmitter and receiver on top of each other and it still didn't bloody work properly. Any questions?
Yes, so did I. I used to have an IR printer with my Braille note years ago, poor little Canon trouble jet it was, and at a couple of inches distance it worked, but not further than that.
Yeah, the IR in the Braille note wasn't all that good, actually. But I had, I think it might have been about 1986 or so, I actually was doing a course in Adelaide, and interestingly, they used...
Did we lose you there, Kate?
I don't think so.
Any other comments before we go on to cellular technology? So in other words, wireless IR technology is really not as good as it's cracked up to be, in my opinion anyway. Okay. Cellular telephones. Those are those things that some people often argue will cause brain cancer and ear cancer and hip cancer because you hold them up near your brain and your ear and wear them on your belt, etc., etc. I think in my mind they actually cause cancer of the wallet and cancer of the bank account because they all come with dodgy plans that are nothing but scams. So these nice little modern cancerous devices are here to stay with us, and we're going to have to learn about them. So here goes. Originally only designed for voice communications, you can now send data and videos and all sorts of things on the cellular network. Wow. You can also hook up portable devices when you don't have Ethernet or Wi-Fi. Yes, Kim and Kylie will tell you about my excursions up the shops and on trains and all over the place using my Optus dongle on the Triple E and getting on the internet and talking on Skype. Okay, and that uses the cellular network.
Or there's the time when you had to use the Optus dongle when there was no DNS, and that was the first lecture of Discovery last semester. That was something, that was.
Yes, baptism of fire for when Jackie and I went to present last year's Discovery Lecture, Chapter 1. Yes, the amount of times when we had TPG IP, which we no longer have, we actually have TPG, but none of their dodgy IP anymore because we got the problem straightened out. Yes, the amount of times that Optus dongle saved us, particularly in the JAWS scripting course, actually, on Saturday mornings, where we would have that as the backup system, and sometimes the backup system would be used for the lectures, etc. And so, yes, thank you for reminding me, Kylie. It was good fun, wasn't it? Oh, it was different. Yeah, it was a bit of fun, a bit of latency, but it works. And as Kim will tell you, the amount of trips, twilight walks I've done on Skype around the Mount Waverley area here, it's been really good, hasn't it?
It has been good.
I used to, when I first knew Kim, we used to go for nighttime twilight walks, and I'd take the AAA out and talk to her on Skype at like 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening. Actual fact, the while I'm on that point, that's a 3 megabit per second link. It usually hooks up at about 1.6, it says. There are faster ones around now, and now that my plan is up on the 20th of this month and I have the Vostro and the newer PC, etc., it's probably worth my while finding out what better ones I could get for the same price if necessary. So there you go. It'll only get better. I know they have sped up the network, Optus have, but I'm a bit out of touch with what's available, you know, plan-wise and feature-wise. But anyway, it says here in the notes that Kylie provides, who has a stick? Who's got a mobile stick in this class? I've just told you I have. Anyone else got one?
Me.
What? And how do you find it, Kate? Yes, and I know Kylie's got one. How do you both find it? I've just talked about mine.
I don't use mine a lot. Mine's on a prepaid plan, but I have it because my daughter was having trouble connecting to her school network. And I found that giving her that meant that she didn't matter if the school network wouldn't work, she could still get onto the internet and do stuff. I also use it a lot when we go away on holidays. The only problem I had with it was that because it belongs to Telstra, the interface was pretty horrible. And just recently I went on to the website for the device and found a new interface for it, and actually it's now reasonably accessible with JAWS.
Oh, very good. Now, that's Telstra, so I was about to say you're in the rural area where Telstra is our largest company here in Australia. So you've obviously, because I took mine up to Ballarat, the Optus one, back in April, and found, I don't know whether this is because it was a wet, miserable day, but I did have a bit of trouble getting it to connect. I did talk to Kylie and Kim from there, once from a car and once from a friend's house, and it sort of, the signal degraded throughout the conversation I was having with Kylie, didn't it? And it sort of got to the point where I had to quit.
It wasn't that great.
I think that other company doesn't have quite the
You can say that. Optus range doesn't have the coverage that Telstra does. Everybody knows it. It's just that and Vodafone have got even less. It's just that it's basically like what suits you as to how much you want to pay, because the prices do vary. And and also I got mine with a telephone. I got mine a little bit cheaper because I have my phone with Optus, etc. So, yeah, you've got to consider price as well as the technical stuff when it comes to all of these sorts of things.
And I think
One of the reasons that
I have Telstra is because I know that a lot of what I'm going to be doing is going to be in regional areas.
Yeah, exactly. And Mount Macedon being one of them. Kylie, you want to say anything about yours?
It's certainly saved my bacon in presentations where I have gone to places where the Wi-Fi has been spotty and been expected to get onto the net and do things and not been able to. So it has really saved my bacon in those situations. I don't use mine often either, and it's Vodafone, and the interface is disgusting, but it's certainly a good tool to have. I couldn't recommend them highly enough for those of you who don't have them, because they allow you to be connected anywhere there's coverage.
Exactly. The little Hawaiian one I've got, which is one that Optus used 2 years ago, has a reasonable little interface. It sort of works quite well with JAWS. So anyone else want to comment on that, John or Kim?
John does not have one.
I'd like to have one.
Yeah, maybe one day. I know you don't have one, Kim, but you never know.
They're expensive here.
Well, yes, data plans in America, Canada, England, Australia, they're all pretty expensive. All right, chances are your mobile stick will support, according to the notes, Global System for Mobile Communications, or what's referred to as GSM. That was the original Ericsson standard back in the early to mid-90s. It's really the worldwide cellular network, unless you happen to be in America, where things are very different. It also will support, and there's a general, well, GPRS, which is called General Packet, GPRS, which is General Packet Radio Service. Now, I used to see my old, actual fact, my Nokia will still connect using GPRS. You usually find those plans are expensive, and you will usually find that the 3G dongles, the dongles of the ilk of Kylie's and Kate's and mine, will often fall back to GPRS, which is what it could have been doing the day I was in Ballarat, come to think of it. Because I have used it on a country train on the way up there too, and it was very sort of spotty and funny. So it often does that. I think the three systems here in Australia will also use Telstra whilst in the... Sorry, they use their own system whilst in the cities, and then they'll fall back to Telstra's GPRS system. And if you roam outside of the area that you're meant to be in, like the capital cities, for example, you're okay while you're in the capital city, like Perth or Adelaide or Melbourne or Sydney or something. Once you go outside of the area and lose the 3G coverage, it can go back to GPRS, and especially if it's going to go cross-network onto the Telstra network, will cost you a bloody fortune. So any Australians out there, avoid it. Which was one of the considerations. I looked at them all. I spent the whole afternoon going around Vodafone, Three, Optus and Telstra until I settled on the Optus one. And they're the things I checked for. You know, am I going to be very easily on the outskirts of Melbourne one time and not knowing and roam into the GPRS area? I could well do. If it happened on the Optus system, it wouldn't be a problem. If it happened on the Three system where it switched to Telstra, it would cost quite a bit. So we decided not to do that. Despite the fact that everyone said the Three service was good, so it was probably good whilst you're actually on it proper. So that's the general packet. So that's the general packet radio service, which really couples with GSM. Now there's other things here like quad band. I know my phone is at least a tri-band phone, and this allows the mobile phone or modem, because that's what these sticks are, to operate on all four major bands, and they are the 850 meg band or megahertz band, the 900 megahertz band, the 1800 megahertz band or 1.8 gig, and the 1900 or 1.9 gig or 1900 megahertz band. Once I found out that my phone was at least tri-band, I knew that I'd have no problems working it in America, and I didn't. I could use my own SIM card. I'll put an American one in I got my hands on. And the same will probably apply to Canada. So that's the quad band. So they're in your notes, the four bands, the four common bands. I think Australia are using the 800, 900 meg bands. I would stand corrected on that. Somebody like Kerry might know. Another thing to be aware of with mobile phones is it does support short message service, or SMS, which is, you know, a text of 160 characters, or as we used to say pre-talking mobile phones, sighted message service. After SMSs, we then went to MMS, which is the multimedia message service. Multimedia messaging service, which allows you to put through pictures and multimedia. Now we've got this enhanced data rate for GSM, which is EDGE, I hope that's not in the test, provides increased data rates and improved data reliability. Now that came out at some point and I couldn't tell you exactly when. Now there's this other one called Evolution Data Optimized, EV-DO, good grief. Even more faster download rates, good grief, how fast does it get? And you've got here something like, and there's this high speed, this is another one here guys, high speed downlink packet access, which is HSDPA.
That's what mine supports.
Ah, right. It says here it provides enhanced 3G support access. So there you go, it's all for the 3G network. So there you go, it's probably what mine supports too. But there you go, certainly what Kylie's does. Setup is easy.
I think mine does.
I think all the ones of the York that we're talking about probably would, yeah. Setup is easy. Just use a PC card, a stick, or an adapter built into the computer and hope you get on with it. Yeah, all right. Well, it comes up as another modem, and if you get Windows conflicts, well, yeah, good luck. Something I wanted to ask you about there, Kylie, was you've got here G1, G2, G2.5, and G3. Is it meant to be 3G and the other way around, or is it the way you've expressed it, or what?
No, that's the way it came in the notes.
All right, well, it says here G1. We usually say 1G here. Before I go on, any questions? No, good. Okay, now, I think this sort of stuff will be in the exam. I seem to remember it being talked about last year. 1G, or G1, is voice only. Analog voice only, or AMPS, which is the analog mobile phone system. We used to have that here in Australia. And I think
there was an exam in Chapter 6, but there isn't in this one. But yes, it was in Chapter 6, if I remember rightly.
Right, amps. Good old amps. I remember seeing a lot of equipment thrown out by Telstra about all that once when I was with you. Okay, so that's the old analog voice only system. God, wasn't it fun with the Bearcat? Whoops, shouldn't have said that. Okay. Okay, G2 or 2G? Digital voice conferencing, calls, caller IDs, and data speeds that are less than 20K kilobits per second. And that is GSM. So in other words, it's what we got in the early to mid-90s is 2G, or I say 2G, it says here G2. So that's your GSM, which has your SMSs and a bit of data and caller ID and two lines and all that sort of stuff. I remember getting a call waiting on my mobile back in 1995 and going, wow, how do I deal with this? When I'd been dealing with it on the normal telephone system for some years prior. G2.5. Data speeds increase now to 30 kilobits per second, to 90 kilobits per second. Supports web browsing, short audio and video clips, games and applications, and how many ands are in this sentence? And ringtone downloads. Yes, we all know about people getting ringtones off websites and being diddled for that. And it also supports GPRS. So that's your, we say 2.5G here in Australia anyway. Cisco call it G2.5, so take your pick. G3, oh, wacko, G3 or 3G, that's what we're pretty much up to now. We've got data speeds between 144 kilobits per second and 2 megabits per second. Yep, there it is. It will support full motion videos, streaming music, 3D gaming, and faster web browsing. EV-DC. EV-DO, I beg your pardon. Okay, now we've got G3.5, and that's probably what they used to call here Next G at one point. I wonder when Next G will become pre-G in the respect that the market has got to it a few years back. So 3.5G, we'll call it. Which is really an extension of 3G. Data speeds up to 384 megabits per second to 14 megabits per second. That's really getting into the realms of ADSL speeds here. We'll get high quality videos out of this, streaming videos, of course. High quality streaming conferencing and voice over IP. Something called HSDPA. Girlfriend, what does that mean?
High speed downlink packet. We mentioned it before.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, anyone gets loves their acronyms, you have a field day with this mobile junk. Any questions before moving on to the next part? All right, no questions. Okay, 11:38. Everybody's favourite Wi-Fi 13.1.4 Wi-Fi. Don't we all love Wi-Fi? It's really cool stuff. We learn a lot about it in Chapter 7 of the Discovery course. What do we know? What do we already know about Wi-Fi, gang?
It's the IEEE 802.11 standards, either A, B, G, or N.
Kate's good, isn't she? Well done. Okay, now there are some differences, as Kate's already mentioned, the four now common standards. Okay, now GNN, 802.11, G and B and G use the 2.4 gig band, And A and N use the 5 gigahertz band. So let's find out about some of the standards. We'll take a closer look anyway.
Actually, N uses both, which is why it's so good. You can even buy dual band devices now, which is kind of cool.
It's good, isn't it? Yeah, I was going to point that out. A isn't compatible with the others. B is not backward compatible with A. G is backward compatible with B. So you can get a G device and talk to a B device with it. N is backward compatible with G and B and probably A.
Yes, it is.
So there you go. So go for N, guys. Okay, so let's have a look at the timeline here. We have 802.11a sort of came about in 1999 and has a throughput rate of 54 megabits per second. And we can actually use that up to about 100 feet or 3.5 meters. This doesn't add up. 30.5 meters, thank you. 30.5 meters, so there you go. Now, also in 1999, they invented or released 802.11b, which went backwards when it comes to the speed because you're down to 11 megabits per second, but that's okay because it still had the same range, 100 feet and 30 meters or 30.5 meters according to this. And if you hung around until 2003, you would have got 802.11g. I remember when that was being talked about. It was probably being ready to be ratified at the end of 02 early. I remember being talked about in 03 anyway. Will and all that gang started getting to it about then. 802.11g 802.11g as I said, cropped up in 2003 and went back to our 54 megabits per second. So we got our speed back, gang, and we also got the same distance, which is 100 feet or 30 meters or 30.5 meters. And then, yes, I remember back in 2008, just before it was ratified, and it's now ratified, as of 2009, 802.11n, 802.11n, which gives us a quantum leap in speed, 10 times that of its former G and A counterpart, at 540 megabits per second, and we can get a lot more range out of this beastie at 165 feet or 50.3 meters. And some of this junk will probably be in your exam, so have a look at the notes. Any questions? All right, now with wireless, one of the big things, of course, you have to be aware of is security, because we don't have a nice little cable connecting your device to your server or your router or wherever you want to go, which means that it's on the electromagnetic spectrum, which means, like a radio, it can be listened to. So we always think about security when we're talking wireless, unless you're dumb. Never send login or information unless you're... using clear text. You should be using a VPN, or you can use a VPN over a wireless LAN. Use a VPN connection when possible. Well, it's not always going to be possible. But you should at least encrypt using your Wi-Fi system, and most of us here know that. Enable security on home networks. Now, there are some worksheets in Chapter 7 of the Discovery course that take you through that. Kim knows about that because she did it. So does Kylie because she did it. And was there anything in Chapter 8 about all this, Kylie, in our course?
Yeah, there was a
little bit about security. We had WAP, WEP and WPA. WEP, which is Wired Equivalency Protocol, got cracked very early and everyone went and got WPA.
There's a bit more in 15 on the worksheets, I think, with wireless security.
Yeah, we look at that in greater detail. That's what we do too. I know it's somewhere in this course. Okay, we are now using WPA and WPA2, which is used to secure our Wi-Fi systems. WPA uses a sophisticated encryption and authentication technology to protect data flow between the Wi-Fi devices and the WPA users. The WPA uses a 128-bit encryption key and should be enabled on all wireless devices. WPA was introduced to replace WEP, or Wired Equivalency Protocol, as I said, which had been known security issues. Yes, it got hacked. Any questions?
It helps when the keys are static, you know. They, once you've found the key, it doesn't change, so you can always use it. Not very helpful.
Yes, that was the problem with WEP, whereas WPA, they're dynamic. Satellite technology is 13.1.5. Two-way high speed. Internet access is available in rural areas and remote areas by satellite. You can get quick file downloads out of this. Okay. And your satellite dish can be used for TV access as well. Yes, there you go, even in cities. All right, now there's some stuff here about setup. 24-inch, 610mm satellite dishes. Yeah, okay, I remember some friends putting up some dishes discussing this. 24-inch, or 610-inch satellite dishes. That's usually the diameter, if I'm not wrong. You need a modem, coaxial cables and connectors, and you'll get 500kbps out of this junk. And you'll upload 50kbps through this stuff. In other words, it's going to be
asymmetric. I suspect you get a lot more, actually, than what Cisco sees now.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I heard it wasn't really that fast, actually. But it can be affected by, and Kylie will know this, by adverse weather and poor placement. And the reason I know Kylie knows this is because I think when I first met her, she said that her sister was having trouble watching pay TV on it. You said it was
yes,
a clear
our,
day,
our pay
right?
TV gets rain faded sometimes, and you hear of farmers down, you know, in the rural areas using it because they don't want to use dial-up, and their dishes fill up with snow in the wintertime, which is not very good.
No. I wonder how that happens in Canada. Kim, do you hear about people's satellite dishes filling up with snow?
Actually, I don't know, because I don't really know a lot of people that use the satellite TV, of course, but not internet, so I'd have to look at that.
Well, there again, you lot are so bloody north, you've almost got your dishes facing facing horizontal to catch the satellites nearer the horizon, I guess. I've seen a few on the Google Earth there, so closer to the equator, you're going to point them up higher. So you will probably get more snow in them. Okay. Oh, that's all there is on satellite. Good grief, we got to the end of that bit already.
Yeah, the notes don't say a lot about satellite.
And we had covered it last week, I think, or the week before, so hey, there wasn't really much need to.
Yep. You see a few of them around Melbourne too, because there's, why are they using satellite here? Oh yeah, pay TV, where they haven't cabled it. Vicky's place down the road's, or it hasn't been cabled, and they've got a few dishes on some of the houses there. My area here over the road's cabled. So you don't see them here in Mount Waverley so much. Repairs to laptops. Okay, here we go. This is a good bit. When your laptop starts to play up, buy a new one. No, we're not rich, so we have to get it fixed. What you do depends on is whether the thing is still under warranty and which party's on the blink. Who wrote this? Kylie probably did. Okay, if it's under warranty, don't touch it. Anything you do as a technician could void the warranty, or if you touch it, make sure you don't get caught. All right, and it won't be the first time you have, if anyone ever does. But yes, make sure you don't get caught, because you could void the warranty. If it's not under warranty, you can look at replacing some of the components, like we did. Okay, the components that you can replace divide into two categories. What are they, given the fact that we've all done Chapter 6, I think it was?
Some of the parts are user replaceable parts, and some of the parts are bits that can only be replaced by the service people.
Yep, and the proper terminology is as follows. Customer replaceable unit is the bit that, as Kate said, you can replace yourself, or a crew, CRU, or a field replaceable unit, which can be replaced by the person who's a technician in the shop or in the field if they come and visit you. Which is a FRU, and things that are covered by each of these is in the customer replaceable units includes batteries and RAM. Really? Okay. I suppose it does. Most of them have got a slot on the bottom. Field replaceable units are usually motherboards, LCD backlight or LED backlight. Inverter and keyboard, arguably, in brackets. Who wrote this, Kylie?
I wonder why I put arguably then.
I had a chuckle. I was telling Kim about that when we were on the Skype before. I said it during our dinner break. I was reading this and after I called you. And I know I had a big chuckle to myself when it says here, it says field replaceable units is for anyone who wants to know. Field replaceable units, it says this includes motherboards, LCDs, backlight and inverter, and keyboard in brackets, arguably. This is because of an interesting little story. And Terry Mack is not with us today, but she'll remember this fondly because it was the first night I met her. And my friend Will, who's known to some of you from the social on a Friday morning or Thursday night, depending on your part of the world, decided he was going to replace my keyboard in my Triple E because I was too lazy to do it. And guess what? We did it while we were talking to Kylie and Terry on Skype. So arguably that's why she put it there. It isn't really, it's not going to pass you in a Cisco exam if you tell Cisco that you can replace a keyboard as a hot swappable device while the computer is turned on, so don't do it. It's just that we like telling it as a war story. Yes, we often get up to things we shouldn't. I won't tell you about the time I forgot to take the battery off the Triple E when we put new RAM and a new hard drive in it either, but anyway, that's another story because we're very neglectful. But you are not going to pass your Cisco exam if you do so silly things, so don't do it.
Don't do what I do, do what I bid.
That's it, you got it. Don't do as I do as I say. So for these FRUs, or field replaceable units, it is better to send it off to your local technician. I'll call a friend, like I did. In actual fact, the last time the hard drive was replaced in my Triple E, I was doing it myself on the dining room table, and that's when Kim rang up and said, why don't you always talk to me from the dining room, because the telephone sounds better out there. So there you go. So I had a handful of screws and half a hard drive sticking out of its bracket while trying to hold a phone conversation. Again, be careful. If you are taking your hard drive out of your laptop, make sure you get the screws in different containers, because there was a couple of screws that held the door on. There was a couple of different size screws that held the bracket into the unit, and a couple of different size screws that held the hard drive on the bracket. So if you are going to take these things apart, make sure you don't get the screws mixed up, because it can be not good if you did. You can use a repair centre if you're not so game like we are, which is really what they're telling you here in the notes. Repair centres can be generic, or they can be manufacturer specific or service agents of the manufacturer. So there you go. I won't tell you the reason why we replaced the keyboard in my Triple E, because the service centre was going to cost us a fortune and we could do it for a fraction of the price with a third party keyboard from eBay and a bit of nous. Okay. It's a good idea to know what type of centre you're using, it says here in the notes. Especially if your unit is still under warranty. Yes, common sense. You may have to send the laptop away to a regional centre of the manufacturer if you don't have the right repair centre near you. Yes, well, yes, that can also slow things if you have to send it away somewhere. These places can offer the following bullet points. Hardware and software diagnostics. Data transfer and recovery. Yes, well, you can do that for yourself now because you're our IT students. Hard drive installations and upgrades. As I said, the dining table made a good workbench for me a few months back. RAM installations and upgrades. Keyboard and fan replacements. Internal laptop cleaning. Yep. LCD screen repair. And LCD inverter and backlight repair. And Kim would know about this. So there you go. And they can cost you a lot of money. So when you're vision impaired, often people don't bother. Right, Kim?
Yeah, I've done that too.
She's obviously not listening at the moment, but...
Sorry, yes, I had a phone call.
Oh, right. We're just talking about your gateway, hun. The service centre can repair the screen, which they didn't do in your case because you didn't want to fork out that money.
Wanted about $300. And I said, because they said, oh, we won't replace your hard drive unless you get the screen fixed. So I bought another hard drive.
And went down the road and got someone to put it in for you or something, is that right? Oh, did you and your dad do that one yourself too?
No, I put it in there.
Okay, there you go. So there you go. We're all technicians even before we did this, IT. There you go. Keyboards, hard drive.
I know.
Weary of service centers.
Mine's on its third hard drive, actually. Yeah, sorry, Kate.
I noticed it when it was talking about that, that it said that you can tell that the backlight, there's something about the backlight, it isn't working when you can only see the screen from side on or something. And I'm thinking that might have been a test.
It is, actually.
Can someone clarify that? I don't get what you just said.
Yeah, if you can only see the screen from an angle and not from straight on, if the screen is looks dark from straight on, but you can see it if you look from an angle, then the backlight's gone.
Really? Okay.
And when I read that, it just seemed like a test alert to me.
It is a test
alert. They're saying you can see the screen from an angle. Unless the backlight's polarized, unless there's two poles to the backlight and maybe one pole's gone, maybe that's what they mean, because the screens are polarized. It's an interesting point. I'd like to see that.
The other thing they don't mention, which I think is important, is that particularly when your thing's under warranty, the best way to get it repaired is to go back through the place where you purchased it rather than going directly to the service people or manufacturers.
If it's under warranty, well, yeah, please, people like Harvey Norman here in New Zealand and Australia will have extended warranties where you can do that. They've probably got similar things at the
although their after sales leaves a bit to be desired.
After sales, yeah, look, to be honest, I wasn't prepared to wait and muck around, especially when the only service centre here in Melbourne for the Aces was right where I couldn't get to, and it was going to take a week, and eBay dealt with it in about a day, and we dealt with it a day later by putting the keyboard in. So, what are you going to do? You know, fraction of the price too. Sorry, gang, but that's really the harsh reality of it. But you know, there are people who are in less fortunate positions than ourselves, and do have to be without their machines for the time it takes to send away, which is unfortunate. All right. Any other questions before we go into selecting laptop components? All right. Components can need replacing because a part is worn, damaged, or faulty. You want more functionality such as a wireless card of a newer standard, and you want to put more RAM in it like we did. And careful for those people who have to worry about the JAWS key being now out of date because you've changed the hardware profile. Thank you, FS. Of course, new parts have to be physically and electrically compatible with the rest of the machine. And of course with the operating system that's installed. It's wise to buy new parts from an authorised source. Yes, I did swap my RAM, I think I swapped my new RAM with Robert and Will for a bottle of scotch. But it was the right one because Will knew where to get it from and sent Robert there on the way home to do it. So I just took what they got me on face value and gave them the bottle of scotch. Okay, so the place they bought this from, in my opinion, was an authorised source. I don't know, it was compatible, and they said it would work, so it did. And I've had no problem with it. Like anything, RAM is, you get good quality of it, and you get not so good quality of it, and this one was good. So was it scotch. It's wise to buy it from an authorised source, or at least know what you're doing when you're doing it. Why is this important? Why is it important for laptops? It says here in the notes. When you buy new parts, they're a retail and OEM. Okay, yep, okay, you get a pretty box if you're buying something with retail, and you don't get a pretty box when you get something as OEM. I actually have a feeling, it doesn't matter. Okay, retail package or retail boxes. Components usually come in the retail box or retail package with full documentation. Full warranties, cables, and mounting stuff. So there you go, you get all the bits necessary. OEM, and probably, nice pretty book, and everything on how to install it. OEM components are usually sold without packaging. OEM components also require the user to locate documentation, software, drivers, and any additional hardware that may be needed. They are usually less expensive. Yes, I shudder to think what the more expensive RAM for my computer would have been. They are usually less expensive and offer a shorter warranty period than their similar retail counterparts. So there you go.
What were they saying OEM stood for again?
Original Equipment Manufacturer. Now, it's probably a little bit elusive in the context of extra bits for your computer, because OEM really, when I was first introduced to the term, was used in the context of software. For example, if you went out and bought a computer with MS-DOS on it, or early versions of Windows on it, or not so much even on it, but came with it, because it was illegal to supply a machine that didn't have an operating system, thus rendering the collection of hardware useless, you would get a copy of MS-DOS or Windows or whatnot as an OEM. And you still do. You know, Windows 7 sort of came with an OEM for this machine. It came with a motherboard when I got the new motherboard, etc. But yeah, you buy a computer with an OEM copy of Windows. Therefore, whether it's installed or not installed, it's the copy of Windows you put back on the machine if you have to. Kim and I would have got that with our Vostros earlier this year. However, you can buy a non-OEM copy of Windows or software. So what they're saying is it's supplied with the equipment, therefore it's original equipment manufacturer. That's why they say it's an OEM, because it's supplied with the equipment from that computer shop when you get that equipment and take it home. With the non-OEM copies of software, it's software you buy in a pretty box from a shop after you've got the original computer and you install at a later date. So I don't particularly like the expression OEM when in only the context of hardware, but I'm old-fashioned.
At least, I believe OEM,
yep.
Here anyway, is somewhat of a gimmick, because many times if you go to buy a replacement part, it strongly recommends that you only replace it with OEM parts, which always are.
Yeah, which almost reverses what we've just said. Yeah, in other words, if you're going to get an Asus computer, replace it with Asus bits. Exactly. Yeah, so that's why I don't like it used in the term of hardware. I really think it's stupid. Software, yeah, because it's equipment supplied with the equipment, or software supplied with the equipment, but it can get nauseatingly confusing. In this context, my opinion only exit soapbox.
Yeah, we see, because my computer came with Vista on it, so that would be the OEM, and then I bought a copy of 7, so that's my manufacturer's. That's
exactly. So, yeah, so the OEM copy of the software was the Windows Vista that came with the computer the day you bought it, and you just bought a brand new copy of 7 that you installed at a later date. And that's really the context it ought to be referred to as. None of this hardware junk. Sorry, guys. All right. See, well, this is the thing. When I was in America, guess what I got from California? I got a new battery. So it's not an OEM battery. It's not an Asus battery, in my opinion. I don't know what it is. It's an unlabeled, came in a box that Jackie had waiting for me when I got there, you know, and sits on my Triple E today. You know, so it's a replaceable battery. I didn't get the Asus one. I got something off eBay, and it's really cool. So you can replace the battery. You should replace the battery when the laptop shuts off immediately when the AC power is removed, a la friend of Kim's, who we'll talk to tomorrow about that. So in other words, her battery's created. You should also replace the battery when it's leaking, when the battery overheats, or when the battery simply doesn't hold a charge, which is one of the reasons I replaced the original Asus battery on my Triple E, because it was starting to get inefficient and I thought it would be nice to get a bigger battery anyway. If you can't find a suitable battery, take the old one to a repair centre for testing. I'll just get on eBay. It's probably the more better way of doing it. Sorry, gang. I'll consult the manufacturer for form factor, voltage, power rating, so you can choose the correct battery for your unit. Yes, eBay is full of Asus Triple E batteries, I can tell you, all over the joint.
There is a battery question too in the exam I've just got in front of me, which is and the answers to it are in the chapter 6 notes, not in the chapter 13 notes. So just be aware of that. Review your notes on batteries from chapter 6 also.
Thank you, girlfriend. Follow all charging instructions and remember to discharge older nickel NI batteries. Is that nickel cadmium? I failed chemistry, Kylie. What's NI?
No, yeah, NiCad is nickel
cadmium, yeah. And there's NiMH, which is nickel metal hydrides. Yeah.
There you go, NiMH, and here are the NiMH ones here. NiMH, which is nickel metal hydrides. I remember when they first came out too. Wasn't that all cool? We thought we could get away with half charging our batteries, and that was a furphy. Anyway, so basically it tells you here, charge up your batteries at maximum. I do try and power cycle mine. If I've got my computer unplugged, I'll try and let it get flat and put it back on again. A lot of people, particularly those who are using their laptops as their main computer on the desk, Kim, might want to remind Kate. Themselves that you should unplug it. And Kate too, yeah, unplug it from time to time and let the battery cycle down, or you'll be very sad when you
actually,
need,
with lithium
really
ion, that's not nearly so important.
Hey, well, that's how I buggered the battery in my old BenQ, actually. I didn't sort of power cycle it properly, and that's a particularly hard battery to get, so I haven't bothered. It'll last about 5 minutes if you unplug it. Triple E got a new battery. The Vostro is so new that I haven't had to worry yet. Sorry, Kylie?
Lithium ion, lithium polymer, you don't have to worry quite so much about that, actually. They tend to be the other way. They need charging often, so they are more designed for people who just toss the thing on to charge every night, like a mobile phone or whatever.
Yep. Caution, warning, Will Robinson, handle batteries with care. They can explode. Bang. What a lot of fun that would be. Yuck.
I had a battery explode on me once in a tape recorder I was using at Radio NZ. It was not nice.
Was it fun?
I was in the middle of it was an interview situation. I was in the middle of the interview and suddenly I heard this strange sound and suddenly the recorder wouldn't work anymore and I found afterwards that one of the batteries had exploded.
And it went bang?
Ooh, nasty.
Have you got the? Have you got?
It didn't go bang actually.
Oh, didn't it? Ooh, what a bummer that was. So you even got the outtake you can send me.
I do actually. I couldn't edit it out of the document of the interview because it was so close on the end of a word that I just kept it in there. Most people didn't notice, but it is there. I'll tell you afterwards where it is, where you can find it.
Okay, I've probably already got it. Oh, ripper! I've got a few of your. Broadcast. They're very well done. Kylie, our ex-broadcaster here. Okay. Caution, handle batteries with care because they can explode and that's not very pretty. If they're mishandled or improperly charged, yes, don't put too much current in them or you'll heat them up and boom. Be sure that the battery charger is designed for the chemistry size and the voltage of your battery. Batteries are considered as toxic waste and should be disposed in compliance with local laws and regulations. Okay, any questions before we go into docking stations and port replicators? Evidently not. What are the differences between a docking station and port replicator? Okay, these devices offer several
connections. Docking stations are hard to get
Sorry, what's that, Kim?
Docking stations are hard to get your laptop out of and into again.
A la Kim's friend again, who we'll see tomorrow. She won't take that laptop
actually,
anywhere,
they shouldn't
will she?
Be. They shouldn't be difficult.
My laptop is one of the ones where the docking station is just a plug-in, so that's easy.
Yeah, and I can't help wondering if this friend of Kim's was actually assisted better in past times, maybe she would be able to get in and out a bit more because they shouldn't be too hard, really. Or else, why would people use them? You know, you would just say it's all too hard and you wouldn't use it. Anyway,
a lot of people couldn't get that thing out and in, so I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? It's crazy. We won't mention the brand in case we get in trouble. Okay, these devices will offer an Ethernet connection or an RJ45 connector, which is, Jackie colloquially said last year, an RJ45 connector is like a telephone plug on steroids, which is big. A modem connector. You'll either have an S-Video or TV app connector, a USB 2.0 port, external monitor port, which would be a, in those days, would have been a VGA port, standard analog VGA. These days could be a HDMI. Or DVI even. Parallel port, high-speed serial port, going back a bit, an IEEE 1394 port. An IEEE 1394 port. What's that in layman's terms, gang?
Firewire.
Thank you, John. A stereo headphone output, a stereo microphone input, and a docking port.
That's docking stations, by the way, not port replicators. A docking station's got the full noise, and the port replicators are smaller and less featured.
Yes, exactly. So this is the docking station we're talking about here, I think.
Kylie, would you repeat that?
Excuse me, sorry. Docking stations have got more features than port replicators. And what doesn't mention there is some docking stations even have a sound card in them. I have seen, I think it was the Toshiba Dynadock U. It's been superseded by the Dynadock V, which is a universal one that has a sound card in it, I believe. So, but you'll find that port replicators are smaller and they have only ports. Docking stations have extra video or sound cards in them, even some of them.
Thank you.
So the difference between a port replicator and a USB hub is that a port replicator would have all the different types of ports, where a hub only has USB ports.
That would be right.
The port replicator also takes the different kinds of cards, if I remember from that lab before.
Some of these connectors are proprietary and connect via a docking port on the bottom. And as they say, some of these things are universal and connect via USB.
I've even seen one for a netbook now, which is very cool.
Yeah, I have a feeling I saw one somewhere on one of the shopping websites. Actually, I saw a neat little thing for an Apple iPad the other day that had a folder that you put the iPad in and it connected up somehow to a keyboard. I think it might have been wirelessly to a keyboard. And you had the whole kit and caboodle would look like a miniature laptop on your knee. It was quite good. Okay, refer to your manufacturer's website or documentation if purchasing a proprietary docking station. So there you go. Selecting storage devices. These are usually CRUs or CRUs, which is customer replaceable units. I guess you could be, and this would be in the realm of external USB hard drives, a Firewire hard drive, a CD/DVD burner, and it's obviously not new enough to know about memory sticks. I don't know why they're not mentioned, but that would be removable storage in my opinion. Again, consult your documentation for compatibility. Laptop HDs, hard drives, have a 2.5 inch form factor and can be either magnetic or solid state. What's the difference, it says in the notes? Did Kylie want us to talk about magnetic and solid state drives?
Yep.
We went through that a long time ago.
Solid state drives have no movable parts and therefore use a lot less power and a lot less likely to fail.
And much faster.
Yep. And go faster. And that's all I'm prepared to do on that because we're going to have to worry about time. The other thing the notes don't actually point out here, and I'm about to do it, is that you can get, up until a few years ago, you would get small parallel ATA 2.5 inch hard drives, which is what's in my old BenQ. But since the mid-noughties, 2006-07 onwards, they come with the SATA connectors. So there you go. Even Jackie's laptop I pulled apart when I was over in Phoenix last year had a SATA hard drive in it, and that was 2006 or 2007 vintage. Kim's old Gateway computer would have been a similar vintage, and I think that had a SATA drive, as does my two newer laptop PCs. So there you go. So they're all SATA now, but there might be still some around with the smaller parallel ATA drives still in them. The SATA ones are, of course, quite easy to replace. Okay. In most laptops, the internal hard drive and then the internal optical drive are connected behind a cover. On the cover, in other words, there's a panel on the bottom. Unscrew it if you want to pull it out and deal with the bracket. I sat there. Jackie was stressing for quite some time about pulling that hard drive out of her machine, and she was frightened. We even looked up how to do it and even got a picture on how to position your fingers, and I just gave up in the end and I said, I'm just going to give it a good heave-ho. I was quite relieved when Carl said that he was glad I didn't break his wife's computer. because it was a bit tight to get out, but we were doing it right. It's just that we needed to give it a bit more oomph. And you often wonder sometimes when you're pulling these things to bits, are you actually going to break stuff? So you do need to be careful. On some laptops, the keyboard, rather than pulling them out via the bottom, I think on some of the newer EEEs actually, the keyboards actually have to be removed to access these components. It's also important to note that Blu-ray or DVD or CD drives may not be interchangeable in the laptop. So there you go. You've really got to stick with the one they want you to use, whereas hard drives are a bit more, a bit more easy to replace. To confirm the currently installed devices, check the POST screen or BIOS. What does POST stand for, gang? Power on, self-test.
It's a system check.
System check. Power on, self-test. Some computers will tell you what's connected during that. Others with the faster boots don't. If installing a second hard drive, or where would you put a second hard drive, honestly? If you're putting a second hard drive or optical drive, confirm the installation of said device in the Windows Device Manager.
My Toshiba has a second bay, I believe, according to the manual. You can put a really small hard drive in there. So I haven't looked to see where it is, but apparently, according to the manual, it has one.
Well, there you go. What do you know? Now, do I have to really go through the path on how to get the device mangler? Your IT students, read your notes. Or else, if you're in Windows 7, just type in Device Manager at the bloody menu. Okay. Okay, if you're going to stick additional memory in, this is 13.3.4. Additional RAM. If you're going to put additional RAM in your computer, it's going to make it run better. Aha. And screw up your JAWS key if you happen to be running JAWS. So make sure you get your FS Activate happening. Okay, it will improve the laptop performance by decreasing the number of times the operating system has to read and write to the Windows swap file. Haha. Additional RAM will also help your operating system run multiple applications simultaneously. What is a swap file?
What's a swap file? We've covered this really recently.
That's the extended RAM on the hard drive.
Yep.
We call it virtual memory. Because really, it's virtual. In other words, it gives, it's just a bit more. Well, it's not really RAM, but it simulates having extra RAM. Yeah. The make and model of your laptop determines the type of RAM chip you need. Usually this will be a SODIMM chip, S-O-D-I-M-M chip. Make sure your laptop have the slots available. And also make sure that it will support the quantity memory that you want to put in. Small form RAM modules Small form RAM modules can have 144 pins, or 174 pins, or 200 pins. And if you haven't got a life, you can count them.
You've got the right pins.
These smaller RAM modules, which aren't SODIMM, can be found in printers and other small devices, where space, as in like physical space, is of a premium. Before buying new RAM, RTFM, what does that mean, gang? Read that fine manual. Read your manual for the form factor and installation instructions. Most laptops, RAM is inserted into slots on the underside of the cover. On the EEE, it's the same cover that you do to the hard drive. It just sort of sits in front of it a bit. However, on some laptops, the keyboard has to be removed, which is what it said before. Caution, before installing RAM, remove the battery and the power. Yeah, we forgot that too. we turned the machine over and realized the battery was still on the bottom of it. So pull out the battery and make sure the machine is completely devoid of power. To check the currently installed RAM, check the POST screen or BIOS for the RAM, or Windows system property window, my computer properties thereof. An interesting footnote that I'll put onto these notes is that the first thing I did is when we booted up my PC after we put the extra RAM in it from 1 gig to 2 gigs on the Triple E is that Windows still only saw 1 gig. So I just went in the BIOS and just went into the BIOS and saved the BIOS, and then Windows came up and went, you've got 2 gigs. So don't always trust Windows. It's always better to make sure you go in the BIOS and have a look and save it if necessary. Any questions?
In relation to RAM, I know that when you're running a 32-bit, you can only address 4 gig of RAM. But I've heard some people say that there's actually no benefit in running a 64-bit machine. Is that true?
They're all the people who are too frightened to go out and get drivers for their 64-bit systems will tell you that.
Oh, because my... Sorry,
Kate. Go ahead. Go, Kate, and then the other person. Whether it was Kim or Kylie, I couldn't tell.
With my computer, when I use Balark, it tells me that it's 64-bit ready, but of course... not much point me doing that when I've only got 4 gig of RAM. And I was just thinking about the possibility of upgrading to, you know, say 8 gig of RAM, because I have looked on the website and there are 4 gig sticks available for my computer.
That was worthwhile. It's because your operating system won't talk to it, because it's reached the limit already. So, yeah, you really need a 64-bit operating system if you want to take advantage of 8 gig of RAM. When
also
it says 64-bit ready...
Excuse me.
It's talking about the hardware. Sorry, the processor. Sorry, John, go ahead.
I was just going to tell Kate, with the 64-bit OS, she would have up to 128 gigs of RAM available to her if her laptop supported that.
Yep. I think I read somewhere that 64-bit machines are more secure. I think I was reading in some technology blog or something recently about that.
Yes, and some of your 32-bit zealots also go, oh, you can't get 64-bit Windows because it's got enforced driver signing. Well, big deal. Kim and I have been running that, and I believe Johnny's too, for ages, and it works very well. Sorry, gang. 64-bit Windows is here to stay.
Well, also, the software and everything else coming out is 64-bit, so I think it's...
Yes, and it runs smoother and faster, so there. Yeah, exactly. Sorry, Kate.
So it really would be worth my while doing it if I could afford the RAM.
Well, you need the operating system, because your operating system, from what you tell me, is 32-bit.
Yeah, it is at the moment, but it's telling me that my hardware is capable of doing it, and I've also got the Windows installation, so it'd just be a matter of installing it with the different key to make it 64-bit.
No. Okay, gang, now this harks back to something I said last week in the lecture. There are differences between the 64-bit and the 32-bit Windows operating systems. What I said last week in the lecture, the keys vary the version, a la whether it's Starter, Home, Premium, Professional, or Ultimate Edition, and that is because Microsoft can only have only to shift the one ISO image of Windows. So it depends on what keys to what flavor of the, you know, whether it's Home, Premium, or Ultimate, or Starter, or whatnot that you put in it. But there is a difference between the Windows 64-bit and its Windows 32-bit. You do have to get another version of Windows, a la another CD. The other thing I'm going to point out is that it's a test alert, is that each of those versions of Windows, whether it be 64-bit or 32-bit, do require a minimum amount of hard drive space. It's 16 gigs to do a minimum install, to do an install of Windows 32-bit. And it's 20 gigs to do a 64-bit install of Windows 7. Whether it's Ultimate or Home Premium, etc., doesn't change it. It's that is governed by the key. So it's the actual fact the same software, the same beast. Does that make sense, Kate?
And Windows Windows 7 Starter is only 32-bit.
Yeah. So you're not going to get a 64-bit version of that. So if you're talking from Home Premium upwards, for example, it's the same. If you're within the 64-bit environment, it's the same beast. Within the 32-bit environment, it's another beast.
Oh, well, that's fixed that then, because I can't afford new RAM and a new operating system. So I stick with what I have.
Have what you've got. Yep, I'm sure it's fine. Preventive maintenance. Yes, let's all get out Sea Cleaner and just get on with our lives. Laptops are more likely to be exposed to dirt and contamination, spills, wear and tear, drops, and excessive heat or cold. And excessive moisture on over the page break. That's why I put the or in the wrong bit. It's also important to properly synchronize data between your desktop and laptop. Yep, you either do it manually or go and get Dropbox, like Kim and I did, and boy, we love it. Okay, because that's how I'm synchronizing most of my data at the moment. Scheduling maintenance. Within an organization, routine maintenance should be scheduled monthly. However, but still have the flexibility to vary this in case you need to. This means you should perform maintenance when you see an issue, not wait till something diabolical happens. In other words, be proactive, not reactive. Okay, some of this can include cleaning. Hard drive maintenance, in other words, use disk cleanup if you're doing a Cisco exam, or use CCleaner if you're most of us. And put on your software updates. Keep fluids and food away from your laptop and close the lid when it's not in use. It keeps dust off it. Never use harsh solutions or cleaners that contain ammonia. Nasty. Compressed air. This is just some bullet points. I'm assuming it's just supposedly telling me what you should do here. Compressed air. Yes, these are things that I would say you would use. Compressed air to help clean your laptop. Mild cleaning solutions, cotton swabs, soft lint-free cleaning cloths. Caution, before cleaning a laptop, disconnect it from all power sources. Okay, routine maintenance includes the monthly cleaning of these, the exterior case, the cooling vents, the I.O. ports, display, and keyboard. Keyboard's where you're going to get most of the dirt. Additionally, keep your software and operating system up to date. Run a disk cleaning utility. Perform regular hard drive fragmentation. These tools come in various versions of Windows, or you just go and get CCleaner and Defragler and do it a lot more efficiently and get on with your life. It says here in the notes, although we tend to use these third-party in products, if you want to pass your Cisco exam, you do need to know about these other Windowsy built-in ones. Data version control is the next bit. Restoration and recovery procedures, including backups, are more successful if data is organized. When moving files from a laptop to a desktop computer, start by creating a similar folder structure in both locations, and because the files can be transferred over a network, and you can use portable hard drives, optical discs, and I'm sure I don't need to tell you all this junk because you know it all. Okay.
It does have a test alert in there, so do read the notes on it.
Does it? Yeah, all right. What's the test alert then? Probably something that's very commonsensical, actually, because, yeah, make sure you've got a directory structure that's similar to...
Yeah, it's about file versions. Computer. You can't have the same file name on two Windows machines.
Okay, now I know what you're trying to say. You can't have the same file name in the same directory. You have the same file name in different directories.
Yeah, no, I saw that before, that it said that you can't have the same file name in a particular place, and I thought, yeah, that sounds like it might be something they're going to ask.
Yep, and you are so right, because I remember seeing that before I was doing the preview of the notes before we came on air today. Obviously, what's going to happen if you copy the same file from a source computer to the destination computer, you are going to get prompt, "This file exists," and then you're going to have to decide which one you want to keep by checking the date and time, and if necessary, stopping the copy and opening each file and looking at them. Okay, so no operating system allows files with the same name in the same directory. Yep. Careful not to cut a file from its original location. Copy it instead. Yeah, well, it's up to you, gang. Any questions before we move into our good old hobby horse of troubleshooting?
I didn't mention, I guess, because I've had that and I just renamed the file because I wanted to keep it. But
yep, that's a good way of doing it. Rename one of the files and then you can check them later, yeah.
Actually, speaking of Dropbox, I read an article recently which expressed some concerns about its privacy because there's a key, something to do with when it synchronizes, and Dropbox holds all those keys itself and will give out your information if it feels it's necessary, apparently. So there are one or two zero knowledge ones around. Spider Oak was one that was recommended in this Windows Secrets article, where the company keeps no knowledge of your passwords or your key or anything like that. But Dropbox actually does keep that information, apparently, which has been of concern to some people.
Yeah, it's interesting that because Kim and I use it. We use it because we're distant from each other. We're also using it for the business too. So yeah, I was sort of grappling with this in my mind the other day actually. So because, you know, I've got my key pass up there as well now, but fortunately that's encrypted with a heavy password. But yeah, I mean, say for the convenience of it, you know, we're working on projects together and across the world from each
it's
other.
It's just that it's not the only it's not the only game in town anymore. That's basically what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, we might have to look at other options and do a bit of research if we find that there's a problem with its security. Yeah, no, of course it wouldn't be. Okay, any other comments? Troubleshooting. Okay, we've got some of our common troubleshooting steps about to come up here. When troubleshooting laptops, you may also have to work with peripherals. One, you may have to identify the problem. You will have to identify the problem. You'll have to establish a theory of probable causes. Here we go. Three, determine an exact cause. Four, implement a solution. Five, verify the solution and... verify your solution and also verify full system functionality. Six, document findings. And seven, send the invoice. Now, this is all this how to word troubleshooting, which Jackie and I have been doing since time immemorial. It's interesting when you see it all worded. Then we go into the bit, and we've done all this, I think, in chapter something or other from the first half of the course. The troubleshooting is important and is a skill that is developed as time goes by for people who are new. We also discuss open-ended and closed-ended questions. A example of an open-ended question is, in what environment are you using the laptop? Therefore, you can allow the person to describe, yes, we're in a swamp, a quagmire, and the thing doesn't go anymore. Yeah, not very good. Okay, another open-ended question is, when did the problem start? Yes, the day I chucked it off the back of the tip truck. What problems are you experiencing? It doesn't go. Yeah, that's helpful. What happens when the laptop boots? And is there anything else you can tell me about the problem? Yes, nice big fat open-ended question. You'll probably hear all about their divorce, their second cousin's wedding, and all sorts of horrible things. Some examples of closed-ended questions are, has anyone done any repair on the laptop recently? Because that will invoke a yes or a no answer. Yes or no. It's a closed-ended question. That's all you're going to get.
And it may impact on your warranty, especially if you've had, you know... Brian down the road who's had a look at your laptop when they shouldn't have, when it was under warranty, you may have ruined it. So the tech needs to know things like that.
So you have to know when to ask open-ended and closed-ended questions. Has anyone else used that laptop? Yes or no. Does the laptop connect to the internet? Yes, well, yes or no, and if it connects to the internet, it could have viruses on it. Is there a wireless network interface card or NIC in the laptop? And have you ever had any problems like this before? Okay, now I'm not sure whether these are questions or statements that are coming up here, that it's some bullet points that Kylie's got here. But anyway, that what I've just read are closed-ended questions. There's some what I would call statements here. Laptop battery does not have a charge. Laptop battery will not charge. What's going on here, Kylie? You wrote this. Loose cable connections. External keyboard.
They're just some problems that can occur with laptops.
Oh, samples of problems that could occur. Maybe a heading went missing somewhere. Numlock key is on. Yes,
three different alternative.
These are things that can go wrong. Numlock key is on. Usually, that can cause you a problem. Oh, the caps lock key if you're trying to pass it, type in a username and password. Or loose RAM if the machine won't go. So heaps of things that can go wrong. Things you can do to fix these things. Have you tried rebooting? Yes, the good old Microsoft response. Attach all peripherals. Well, I think if you're troubleshooting, I'd be detaching as many as you could possibly do. Not sure why these statements are here, to be honest. Yeah, you can try operating your laptop using only battery. Print a document from application. This might be a step to do if in the event of something. Type sample document to test keyboard. And check your event viewer. Now you can do that on any computer and find out what's happening. When repairing a laptop, RTFM, in other words, read the fine manual, and observe safe lab procedures. Hark back to Chapter 2 if you want to know anything about that. Document the screw locations. Yes, know where you're getting the screws out of, because how many times when we were all younger did we pull apart tape recorders and found we had a whole pot full of bloody screws? We didn't know where they went. So you don't want to do that to your laptop. Yes, you learn the hard way. So, organise parts. So make sure if you're taking bits out, you can put them somewhere safe and that you can easily lay your hands on them when it comes to back to putting it all back together again. Refer to the manufacturer documentation and use appropriate hands tools. In other words, let's don't go using a plate screwdriver on a Phillips head screw. Okay, we've got some problems here. Is this where we're going to do a bit of troubleshooting with the student's girlfriend, or am I just reading
this
stuff out?
Yes, yep. No, it's... I've got the problem and the possible cause there, but of course we're not going to tell them that bit, only the problem. So, begin.
Oh, I see. These are statements.
Like.
Yeah, I see. I'm only doing this bit. Okay, My laptop screen's gone all dark. And it's making this funny buzzing noise. Anyone have a go at this?
Backlight.
Yes, John. Backlight or... Or inverter fan.
Well, the inverter, actually,
yep.
How might you test that, by the way, if you were looking to see what, if you didn't know, how might you test to see what was wrong?
Well, there is a key switch for turning the screen on and off. I would probably turn the screen off and then back on again and see what whether it changed.
Also, at least the noise would indicate stronger that it would be the inverter instead of the backlight.
I tend to agree with John there. Yep. But yeah, look, if you turn off the screen, it's probably going to shut down the inverter as well, so you're going to hear that pretty quickly. It says here plugging in external monitors, etc., looking at graphics cards and device drivers. Well, no, I wouldn't really. If you're listening for that sort of fault, probably not bother. My hard
but at
drive
least
here's another one. Yeah, go ahead.
At least if you plugged in an external monitor, it would prove that there was nothing wrong in terms of the actual programming and that sort of thing.
Well, I don't know, because actually, it might switch in another display driver, so I would not quite go along with that.
More like the hardware, actually, rather than the software. Yeah.
Mm.
But that's why I mentioned it, looking in Device Manager and just checking that your graphics card is not got any horrible squiggles beside it that it shouldn't have, things like that as well. It's if you don't know what it is, of course, in the notes, it says what the problem is. So it's something that you can learn. But if you wanted to test for these things or wanted to make sure, then there's the other things that you could be doing.
Yeah, now it says here my hard drive keeps spinning and spinning. There's another problem. I can hear it whirring all the time. Yeah. Is that meant to happen? Well, yes, it is. It's if you hear it, if you hear the headset crackling all the time, then that's when you've got a. Yeah, well, it says here, I don't know. I mean, to say, I would have said hard drive activity because the hard drives keep spinning all the time unless the power ACPI turns it off.
Which yeah, you would I've noticed under a lot of conditions in the laptop.
Yeah, I've noticed with mine, you can tell the difference between normal activity, and if it was doing something abnormal, it wouldn't have the same sort of sound. It would probably have an extra noise in it, but I can tell when
noises and sinking noises. Yeah, exactly. Well, what would all right if it's got extra noises, let's say, and it doesn't spin down and it's crackling away and it's seeking and that sort of stuff, what do you think the problem could be, gang?
It's probably starting to fail.
Yeah, the answer they're looking for here is that you haven't got enough RAM. It's going to the hard drive too often. You need more RAM, or you may have an incorrect. You might want to check your virtual memory settings to make sure that it's got a bit more virtual memory on it, or the page or swap files large enough.
Actually, often Windows will tell you if it needs more. It will pop up and say that's what this machine used to do years ago.
Yeah, can do, yeah. Exactly, Kyla. What's that, Kate?
It would seem to me, though, that if you didn't have enough RAM, then that would have been a problem right from the day you got the machine. It wouldn't be something that would start later on.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. Actually, yes, it might well be. But if you've installed a nice big fat a copy of Photoshop on there, and you're running that, and you know a couple of browsers, a word processor, Dreamweaver, or you're doing some audio editing, etc., and you put more software on your computer and running it simultaneously, yes, that problem will become more apparent. The other problem is, of course, if there's any nasties on that computer, they'll chew up system resources too. So it can change as the environment changes, as the the usage of the machine changes. But I do see your point. If the day you got it, you sort of think that should be enough RAM, but no, if you start installing extra software on it, then the environment changes.
Yeah, well, then you ought to be aware that that's what you've done, and that would be the first question that you would ask as the tech is, have you installed any new programs on it recently?
The other thing is the programs and files on the hard drive could become so badly fragmented that it needs a decent walloping with defragger or something. All right, we've got this lovely new laptop, and I put in a PC card, and it wouldn't go, quote unquote. Any ideas, gang?
You put in what?
It says here in the notes, it says, I got this lovely new laptop. I went to put in a PC card today, and it wouldn't go. That's the problem. So what's the causes, according to these notes?
I just put in that for a bit of fun, because it's actually at the end of the notes. Come on, guys. It's a really obvious thing.
I'd go to the device manager and see whether the device had been recognised for a start.
I don't think
No, the card won't fit the slot. It won't go.
Oh, you mean it won't go in the slot?
Yeah, a bit ambiguous, but I know what she's trying to say too.
Oh, you've got the wrong kind of card.
Yes.
You need to get yourself some sort of a card reader so that you can get the right sort of card.
It's one of the things. It says, quote, remove the plastic shielding, you plonker.
You do have to take it out of the packet.
No, correct. The shielding that goes into the slot of the express card slot. You take it out, otherwise you won't be able to fit your card in.
Yes,
Oh,
you're talking about the express card slot.
Oh, yeah, because I know my somebody I know has one of those shield things that goes in the SD slot, and I keep forgetting to take it out before you put the SD card in.
Yeah.
Keep on looking at it. Why is there already an SD card in here? I didn't put one in.
Yeah, it's just a little false one, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've got one of
Triple E.
Yeah, I've got one of those false things in where my remote controller thing goes.
Yeah, that kind of problem's about on a level of someone ringing up saying, "Hey, my coffee cup holder's broken."
Yes, you're too stupid to own a computer. Go bury yourself. All right, so, yes, if you're that dumb, you need help. Time permitting, we will work through 13.5.3 worksheet. So if you're not here, sorry, you've got to do it. 13.5.0 worksheet is a worksheet that if you're not here, you're going to have to submit to Kylie, your instructor. Aha. Okay, if you are here, you can actually reword and reinvent the wheel with us. And here we go.
Actually, it's not reinventing the wheel so much.
All right.
The idea is that you've got information from a level one tech that you have to, you can't repeat the question to the customer, but you have to reword or redirect the customer using that information.
Okay, now I assume the actual questions are on the answer key as well as the answer key. Yeah, so basically what we're going to do is we're going to pretend we're level two technicians. The level one technician has visited this user and their laptop and has failed to fix the problem. And you as level two technicians have got to sort it out without upsetting the customer. Okay. Let me just look
Shall
at this.
I ask the questions and you can direct the answers and things?
Yeah, all right, you do that.
Okay, the first level one question is what are the problems that you are experiencing with the laptop? That's what the level one technician asked. As a level two, what are you going to say to the customer that's going to ask a similar question but maybe get a little bit more information?
I actually can't find the answer key question. I can find...
It's right beside.
So, Kylie, you're...
All right. I'll just make one up. I can't see it.
So, Kylie, your question was...
The question that the level one tech asks is, what are the problems that you are experiencing with the laptop? If you go and pull up 13.5.3, guys, you'll find these questions here, and you're asked to fill in a question from a level two tech that wants to reword or redirect the customer so that you're not repeating the level one technician's question, but you're eliciting a bit more information or rewording the question.
What were you doing? What were you doing when this problem occurred?
I was going to ask, what were you trying to do? Or what made you notice the problem? There was a problem. What made you notice there was a problem?
What are the problems you're experiencing with the laptop? I find this exceedingly difficult for kinesthetes to do, so I'm going to tell you what it is now that I've found it. How long has the underline been malfunctioning? That is another way of rephrasing that question. So you're tricking the user into thinking that they're getting asked a different question when you're really asking the same thing, just to verify what the level one person did. Do you want to go ahead with the second one, Kylie?
Yep, number two. What is the manufacturer and model of the laptop? Now, there's a direction, there's a hint here. Level two needs to get them to do something. So the question is, what is the manufacturer and model of the laptop?
Would you take the laptop over and read me the label on the bottom of the laptop?
That's an inventive one. They didn't have that one.
Well,
as an
in actual
answer,
fact, Kate goes to the top of the class because I was thinking about this very response before. You beat Cisco because I don't like the Cisco answer. And I would prefer Kate's any day of the week. The Cisco answer is go to BIOS and read me what it says at the top of the screen. Now, I thought, Ha ha, Cisco, that we were looking for obvious things first. Why muck around going to BIOS if you can look first look on the lid, where it'll often tell you the brand of the bloody thing, and look underneath or anywhere that bears its model number. Go, Kate.
But how would a person who doesn't have experience go to the BIOS and check it anyway?
Quite right, Kate. Go to the top of the class again. Sorry, Cisco.
I think it assumes in these exercises that you're dealing with experienced users.
Yeah, well,
even so, I can't get to the BIOS.
You just look. Exactly. You know, if you're a technician, when in dealing with experienced users, which in this context I don't think we are, you just simply do it yourself. It's dumb. All right, next question.
3. Which operating system is installed on the laptop? That's the question that Level 1 has asked.
You could ask what version of Windows they have, assuming this is about Windows.
Yep, go to the top of the class, Kim, because the Cisco answer is stupid again. Sorry, Cisco, you got it wrong, and I'm going to say so. This actually says, go to System Properties, in other words, another convoluted answer, click the General tab, and read me the system information. So maybe...
Well, actually, for my sister, that would be a valid answer, because she wouldn't know.
Yeah, mate.
She wouldn't have a clue, so that's the only way for the techie to know if that person provides them with that information.
True. You would therefore, maybe what they're saying here is that they're asking you to get the user to do certain things rather than actually checking it for yourself. It's a bit ambiguous. It's because, if Kylie and I helped Kylie's sister on something last year too, so we would actually ask her to quickly check. So interesting. But I like Kim's answer because I thought it was in the context of just asking questions, not actually getting them to do something.
Well, no, if you're actually, the instructions are that you either reword the question or redirect the customer. It's both.
All right, very well. I'll take it back.
So as a level two, you're going to want them to do things that the level one isn't going to be either experienced enough or qualified to get them to do. Especially if you're working remotely like this,
I'm not in the script, obviously, because I would have thought level one could have directed a customer to go and look on the system properties screen to find out what OS they've got.
Level 1 always gets me to, if I'm troubleshooting hardware, always gets me to go do stuff and doesn't explain what they want, and it's easy to know.
Yeah, our last script writers. Okay, go for Kylie, question 4.
Here's a silly one, actually. This is silly. It says, how is the laptop getting power?
Is the laptop plugged into an AC outlet?
Exactly, John. And that's much better than the Cisco answer.
It says, please plug your AC power connector into the wall outlet. Because it could be getting power from the battery and still running perfectly. So, question 5.
And it's all very well to plug it into the outlet, but let's perhaps also turn it on.
Yeah, exactly. I used to hate doing these as a student. I think, what the hell am I doing this for?
Question 5.
Subject, bleeding obvious. Question 5, for Kylie.
What were you doing when the problem occurred?
That's the same thing as question 1.
Not at all. Question 5.
Oh, what are you? You're right. Kylie's right.
The
problems are you experiencing? What were you doing when the problem occurred? Well, you could be probably having the brain fart necessary to be causing this.
Would you be able to explain to me what you were doing at the time that you noticed the problem?
Yeah, that's kind of rewording the question. This is a very freedom scientific answer they've given here, actually. But it's something that you want.
Answer. I like this one. I like both Kate's and this one because they're both valid. Can you reproduce the problem or error for me? Can you reproduce the problem or error? And that's actually quite important because I often won't troubleshoot, especially remotely, a computer or a problem unless the person is sitting in front of the computer and can pretty much reproduce it. I don't like having it when, and Kylie and Kim will both know this because they both know my auntie, it doesn't go. And I get these phone calls. I got this message. Yeah, what's it say? Oh, I don't know. I haven't got the computer on at the moment. I said, well, I need you to be in front of the computer because I don't know what you're talking about.
The other thing about that is that if they want you to reproduce the problem, maybe the technician should say, would you be able to go through step by step what you did when this problem occurred. So basically start at where you were at and then follow through all the steps you did until the problem came up, because then that should tell you exactly how they created the problem.
And that's why, as an experienced troubleshooter, you'll know when to do that and when not to, because you don't want to make the customer think, because that's always too hard. So what you do is, once you're experienced, it's one of the troubleshooting tools that or tips that'll end up in your arsenal, and you'll do that with it. You'll probably end up asking those questions without even thinking. The other thing you need to be aware of is that if it takes too much time for them to reproduce the problem, and your time constraints are such that you don't have time for them to sort of clown around for half an hour reproducing it. So you need to know when to ask those types of questions. But it is a good technique.
On that technique about step by step, wouldn't you potentially be frustrating the customer or more than getting an answer?
You could do. It's one of those things, you know, when you learn when to. Now, when you've been doing it for 20 years like I have, you do learn when to and when not to ask those things and when to get people to do stuff. There's that frustration factor too. So
I was just going by myself. I don't remember what steps I did before I got that error code.
That's why I often say, look, and you'll see it written in some documentation too, you must be in front of your computer and able to reproduce the problem. And I think they word it like that so that you're not ringing up help desks and going, I'm going to clown around here for half an hour to reproduce the problem. Make the problem happen, then ring up. Question 6, Kylie.
Yeah, this is a bit nebulous too, actually. Were there any system changes on the laptop recently? Although that should be an easy one to clarify. Say the level 1's asked you, and it's not particularly clear. There's a clearer way that level 2 can ask that.
Have you installed any new programs or hardware lately?
Yay.
Well done. Yeah, I like that. And the official answer is, have you installed any new drivers or updates recently? Yep, so there you go. Well done, Kate.
If you ask somebody if they've installed drivers, they wouldn't have a clue. If you ask them if they've installed hardware, then you know they've installed drivers.
Hardware or programs, even anything that could have a profound effect on the environment. Can I? Another interesting question. Question 7, Kylie. Go for it.
Oh,
yes, I don't like this one.
this is ridiculous. Excuse me. Does your laptop have a wireless network connection? Now, what they've given here, actually, see if you can creatively come up with some other ways of listing more information first before you give me Cisco's answer, because it's actually not accurate as far as I can.
No, it isn't.
Can you connect to the internet?
I asked. Well,
how are you connecting to the internet?
Ooh, I like it. Another one. Come on, Kim, let's see if we can get this one out together. What did I ask Shannon the day of the problem with the port replicator?
Oh, God.
Yes. Do you remember?
He probably asked about you asked about Ethernet, and no one had actually told her what an Ethernet looked like, so that was difficult.
Yep. There you go. So this now devalidates the question, because a computer is in my opinion, and this is what Kylie was alluding to, just as legitimately connected to a network if it uses a cable. Exactly. This is why Kylie
this
question.
If you haven't got wireless, it's not going to show up at all. There isn't going to be a wireless connections window, is there? So
because in the case of our friend Shannon, she was having connectivity issues. And no, you're right, Kim. We had to sort out the cable. Remember, we were thinking about that intermittent problem she was having, and we established the fact that she was connecting via cable.
Yeah, but also I think, at least in my Vista machine, it would say wireless connection, and then it would give a signal strength. So theoretically, or I don't think in 7 it does that though.
If you were asking this question, having problem with connectivity, you can go to the system tray and ask them, is there anything on the system tray that says connected to.
You know, I did better than that, and I'll tell you how I did it with Shannon.
Oh, yeah.
And Kate. He could.
That's very sensible,
yep,
Kate.
It is very sensible. Or, in the case of Shannon, we just got her to run her fingers around the computer, and she told us what she had, which turned out to be an Ethernet connection.
Yeah, but Kate is right. You can do that, because mine will say connected internet and local, so that would probably be a good idea.
Oh, Windows 7 does, but remember, Shannon was operating Windows XP, and you'd have to go through one of the wireless connection on the system tray or one of the either a valid LAN connection or the usual spurious network connection too that doesn't have anything connect to it from the system tray, etc. So, yeah, you can use the system tray. Windows Vista does do it a little bit more elegantly, I think.
Yeah, Cisco's answer is, please open your wireless network connection status window and tell me the connection information. Now, if you don't have a wireless card in your laptop, and some customers won't know whether they do or don't, if they're plugged in by cable, then it's not going to even show up. So, yeah, it assumes a lot.
Well, in the case of most laptops do these days, but in the case of, say, Shannon's, for example, she was connected by cable because that's how the technician did it. She's probably never used the wireless on that computer because she simply probably doesn't know how.
It just seems more sensible to look down the system tray and see what items are in it.
Well, if you're working with a sightling, tell them to look down the bottom of their screen to the right by where the clock is.
Well, she's never usually used it on battery, so, and never takes it out of the docking station because the thing's so hard to get back in.
Yeah, exactly. So she's never had cause to use it. So, yeah. So this is assuming that most people on laptops are doing wireless. In the case of my place, yes, because they're usually in other rooms. But I think Kim, you have yours mainly connected by cable, unless you need to take it over the other side of the room, don't you?
Yeah, usually I do.
Hmm. Okay, so that's an interesting question. It assumes that you're always going to run a laptop on wireless. Not always necessarily so. Ain't necessarily so, said...
Normie Rowe said a version of it.
That's it, Normie Rowe. Mental block as a sound. Bloody hell, who was that Normie Rowe?
It's a good... It's a Gershwin song from Paul Yin Bess. It's a great song.
It's a lot older, lot older than Normie Rowe, I can assure you.
Question eight, Kylie.
Okay, is your PC card installed securely? Now, this is a bit of an instruction. I mean, the customer could say, oh, I don't know.
Yeah. Now, this
is
assuming...
Would you take your PC card out and reinstall it, please?
Yay!
Take your PC card. Well, assuming, you know, it's a very interesting question. Remove the PC card from the laptop and reinstall it. So that's the official answer.
The only thing I would add to that is ensure that you feel it click into place.
Exactly.
Because that's obviously what they didn't do in the first place.
I think sometimes these things involve you having to put yourself in the position of a customer who wasn't as knowledgeable as you, and it's easy actually to forget, because we get this knowledge. It's easy to forget that, you know, or put yourself in the position of someone who you know who might ask these questions or might need a bit more help. And the last question is, how much RAM does your laptop have?
Well, again, you would go to the system properties.
Yay.
Yep. And that's it. Go to the system properties and read me the memory information that your computer has on it. Well done, gang. So John, Kim and Kate do not have to do that worksheet. Yay, get out of it. And for those
what number was that?
Listener land. Ha ha. It is 13.5 from 5.3
from memory.
Yep, that's what it says here in the notes Kylie gave me. So well done, folks. We are up to the quiz,
Kylie,
but we are
over
time.
Kylie, do you need to say anything before I take off for dinner?
There's a wind up.
It's actually we've gone past time, so way past time.
No, I totally agree. So let's not have the quiz.
Yeah. No, John. No, only I was going to say to people before we go, please keep the work coming in. I would hate to think of any of you getting too far behind by the time lecture's finished in another couple of weeks, because then you'll only have another sort of 5 weeks or so to do everything. And if you can keep up, it means you've actually got time to revise for any exams and bits and pieces. So, and if you decide you want to take the 11 to 16 final, that's optional. But yes, don't allow yourselves to get too far behind. Now you're nearly there, guys.
Two more lectures to go, gang. So congratulations on getting this far. And even for the people out there in listener land, congratulations. Everyone's done very well.
And thank you, E, for doing this lecture. I really couldn't have...
That was a bit of fun. It was a pleasure. I haven't had a good time like that.
I'm going to go and have lunch. I can smell it cooking.
And I'm going to go have something to eat too.
Okay, and I'm going to go and produce this. So I'll talk to you very soon, girlfriend, and I'll talk to you very soon, Kate. Catch you later.